From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the leader of the drive to bring the 2020 Democratic National Convention to Milwaukee says the effort is about much more than politics.
We're just really trying to show that, hey, look, Milwaukee can not only handle a massive political convention, but it can handle all other types of conventions and events, and people need to start taking Milwaukee seriously, and people need to be put on notice that Milwaukee is ready.
Then award-winning filmmaker and Milwaukee native John Ridley is gung-ho about his new creative hub, No Studios.
I got to go out and do as much as I can to try to support this space because it's of emotional, educational, intellectual value to me to make this work. So yes, the short answer to your question is whatever I'm doing out there, I certainly will be trying to bring here.
And we'll hear from Milwaukee poet Ed Block, who has a new collection out called Seasons of Change. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. There is not always much that rank-and-file Democrats and loyal Republicans agree on in Wisconsin, but it seems that an effort to lure a major event to Milwaukee is one such thing.
The Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, a generally pro-business and often politically conservative group, is backing a bid to lure the 2020 Democratic National Convention to Milwaukee. Prominent Democrats, naturally, are behind the effort as well, including Mayor Tom Barrett. Advocates say it would bring in tens of thousands of visitors and hundreds of millions of dollars in economic impact.
The week-long event would be held at the new arena being constructed for the Milwaukee Bucks, slated to open later this year. And while he says the effort is separate from his work with the team, the man leading the bid process is Bucks Senior Vice President Alex Lazary, who joins us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you think Milwaukee is the right place for the Democratic National Convention in 2020?
Well, I think the biggest thing for Milwaukee, one, is that it's a very politically interesting state. So I think in terms of, you know, where a convention wants to be, whether it's a Democratic convention or a Republican convention, Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular is very politically interesting. I think second, I think Milwaukee essentially highlights a lot of what a convention, especially a political convention, really wants to show. I mean, Milwaukee is an incredibly diverse city. It's got a booming downtown. It's got a new arena with a new entertainment district. It's getting younger, and more millennials are moving in. So I think it's really highlighting kind of the future of where this country is going. And I think the other thing, you know, that we're trying to show is that Milwaukee is ready to be on the national stage and it's ready to be put on the map. And, you know, when you see, you know, something like HQ2 and you see a map of all the potential headquarters, cities that could take it, you know, Milwaukee's just not on it. You just don't see it. You see Cleveland, Chicago, Minneapolis, but you're not seeing Milwaukee. And I think a lot of that just has to do with the fact that no one thinks Milwaukee is capable of hosting something like that. And we're trying to really disband those preconceived notions of kind of what people think of Milwaukee and really try to show Milwaukee is this great, young, vibrant city that I think everyone wants to come to, and when anyone visits, says like, oh my God, this is one of the best cities I've been to. I had such an incredible time. And we're just really trying to show that and show that, hey, look, Milwaukee can not only handle a massive political convention, but it can handle all other types of conventions and events, and people need to start taking Milwaukee seriously, and people need to be put on notice that Milwaukee is ready.
As you say, Wisconsin is a politically really interesting state right now. Obviously, Milwaukee is one of the two real Democratic hotbeds in the state. Is there a little bit of flag planting that this would do as well?
I don't think so. I think what we're really just trying to show, again, we would have loved to have had a Republican convention or a Democratic convention. What we're really just trying to show is that Milwaukee as a city is ready to be on par with the likes of Minneapolis, Denver, Raleigh, Charlotte, even a Chicago. And that's really what we're trying to show is that Milwaukee is the biggest city in a pretty major state. And we need to start taking Milwaukee seriously as a convention destination, as an event destination, and as a destination for corporate relocations and for young people who are looking to go somewhere that's affordable, that's fun, that's got great culture, great restaurants, great sports teams. And that's a city that people want to live in. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, you're in the Midwest and you get a bad rep because it's cold out, you know, in the wintertime. But it's no different than in Minneapolis and Chicago. Those places are cold. Toronto gets cold. From New York, New York gets cold. And so what we're really just trying to show is that Milwaukee is a place that people want to be and that people should want to be. And once they come here, we think once it's highlighted and shown in that kind of national limelight, we think that people will start to see Milwaukee and be like, oh, that's a place I need to be and that's a place I want to go.
At the same time, clearly you are chairing an effort to bring the Democratic National Convention to town and not the Republican National Convention. There is something in having a Democratic convention here that must resonate with you.
I mean, look, I don't think there's any secret that I'm a Democrat. I just went to the last one in 2016 as a delegate and had a great time. But it's not something where I was like, oh, I need to have the Democratic convention. I think we looked at it as and we saw, okay, the Democratic convention chooses first. And we think that because of the timeline of the Democratic National Convention and how they're going forward, we wanted to make that our bid effort. And we thought that it was smarter to go after one rather than two because then we could focus our efforts. And so whether it was going to be the Democrat or Republican one, to us, we wanted to go whichever one was going to go first. And so we thought that that was going to be the best chance that we would have at getting one. And that's why we put our flag in for the Democratic convention. These conventions bring over 50,000 people, over $200 million of economic impact. You know, hotel rates are going to go up. Economic activity is going to be up, and not to mention the national limelight that you get for, you know, over a year of people just saying, okay, the road to Milwaukee, you know, what's going to happen in Milwaukee, and then the national spotlight you get during that week when everyone's here. That's what we were going for, and that's why we think this is such a big deal.
What kind of insight can you give us into how the bid process works and what the timeline is?
So we think that the RFP for the convention will come out in the next couple of weeks. We'll submit our bid, you know, probably a month or two after that. This summer is when they'll start to do site visits, and we'll take them around and really show them Milwaukee. The arena will be pretty much done by that point. So we'll, you know, be able to really show them what the new arena will look like, give them a great outline of what the entertainment block will look like, and really just give them a great sense of why Milwaukee? And then in the, you know, kind of around, I think, November, December of 18, they'll announce the finalists. And then in February or March of 19 is when they'll announce the site. And we're in this to win it. We think we have a great chance at this convention. We think that the story Milwaukee has, not to mention the affordability, ease of transportation, and the nightlife and the new arena will all play a big role in why we think Milwaukee is the destination for the Democratic National Convention and why we think we're the best city to host.
You mentioned the new arena, and obviously that's on pace to be done here in the next few months. What still would need to come together for this to be a successful bid? I mean, between now and 2020, what else would you see as needing to be in place or on the road to being in place?
You know, I think right now we've really got a great story. I mean, we've got to finish the arena. The entertainment block is going to have to really come together, and we're on the road to that as well. We think we'll have some tenants announced in the next month or so, which will really showcase Milwaukee as a destination city. And then I think, you know, I think what else you'll see during this process and, you know, and once we win it is you'll start to see projects, I think, move faster. And, you know, that's something that they saw in Philadelphia, something they saw in Denver and in Charlotte and in Cleveland, which is, you know, hotels that were thinking of coming online or maybe had a longer time horizon to get done, they're going to get pushed to move faster. And so I think that's something we'll start to see. And I think you will start to see projects and development just start to come in with tighter timelines. And I think, you know, there's some things in the city that we just need to make sure that we're cleaning up to, you know, as the convention starts to come here. Now we've got a real timeline for, okay, this is when Milwaukee's about to be showcased. And I think, you know, the 10,000 affordable housing units that the mayor just proposed is a great thing that we need to try to push as we try to showcase Milwaukee as a hospitable wave, you know, city of the future that's welcoming to people of all races, genders, and people of all ages to come here. And I think, you know, now that we've got this convention timeline and we're about to be put on the national spotlight, we can really use that timeline to, you know, to kind of push projects forward a lot faster.
What about the finances of a project like this? How much has to be raised from within?
So for the bid effort itself, we're trying to raise about $1 million. And we're well on our way to that. We've got a ton of corporate support so far. And that's a big part of this effort, is to really show the DNC and the entire selection committee that there's community support here. And then we're going to go out into the community and talk to stakeholders, talk to community leaders, and show that there's also grassroots support as well. So we're on our way. We're raising money from, you know, from Democrats, Republicans. We're working with the MMAC, the Milwaukee Chamber of Commerce, to help with getting corporate support. We're working with the M7 region to make sure that we're getting buy-in from, you know, kind of all of Wisconsin and the entire region, because, you know, they're going to play an important part of this bid effort as well. Once we're announced the winner, what ends up happening is, you know, you have to raise probably anywhere between $60 and $80 million for a convention. In Denver, 80% of that fundraising came from outside the state. So when you really look at money being spent in Wisconsin, that is a lot of money coming in that otherwise would not have been here. And we think that's why this is going to be such a major economic driver.
You mentioned transportation, the idea of extending the streetcar to the new arena has been floated and proposed and has sat out there for a while. How important is getting that piece of the puzzle done for this?
I mean, for the new arena, we've created accommodations for the streetcar. I think it would be great to have it extended to the arena. You know, it's just another transportation option. You know, for a convention, you know, you have security concerns of bringing something that close. But, you know, again, having other transportation options to get you to the arena is huge. I mean, I know in Philly and I know in Charlotte and in Denver, you know, sometimes transportation can get tough. Traffic is going to be a major issue in terms of driving around any city. So having affordable public transportation is big. But what also makes this entire, what we think makes this this bid superior to other bids is Milwaukee is a very walkable city, especially in the summertime. It is not grossly hot, so you're not in your suit just sweating through it. You know, there are over 3,000 rooms, you know, kind of within walking distance, I think within a 20, 30-minute walk of the arena. So there are a lot of transportation options to get to the arena. Having the streetcar there would just be another added bonus that that we think would be helpful. And again, I think that's what's great about giving a deadline. You know, hey, Milwaukee is about to be on the national spotlight in 2020. Okay, we need to make sure that the streetcar is extended. We need to make sure that you know, that the roads are, you know, are all paved, and that the city is looking, you know, its tip-top best shape for when we get the convention.
Events such as this one are touted for the jobs they create, the economic impacts leading up to and during the intense week or so that the convention takes place. But what are the long-term effects of a convention like this on a city like Milwaukee?
Well, I think the long-term effects are, you know, especially for a Democratic convention, you know, whose base is young people, people of color, and, you know, especially the LGBTQ community. What you're going to see is, by having a convention in Milwaukee and being in the national spotlight, being on TV and having, you know, kind of that base watching the entire time, I think it puts you on the map as a welcoming, young, progressive city, and not progressive in the liberal, you know, Democratic sense, but progressive in a, hey, we're looking forward. We're a city of the future. And I think what that ends up doing is it shows people, hey, oh, there's an option. I'm a college student. I'm watching the, you know, the Democratic National Convention. Oh, it's in Milwaukee. That must be, you know, an interesting place to be. It must be a, you know, a fun young city. Let me go check it out. And I think with a generation, you know, the people in college and in high school now, that generation are more politically active, I think, than any other generation, probably since the baby boomers. And having them watch the convention and having young people watch and saying, oh, Milwaukee, like that, if the Democrats are going there, or if there's a Democratic National Convention there, let me see what's going on there. I need to go visit that city. That city must be a place for young people. So I think in terms of long-term impact, what you're going to see is more people looking at Milwaukee, more people willing to take a risk and a chance on Milwaukee, which is only going to create a snowball effect of more projects, more development, and more economic activity long-term.
I know this work is separate from the work that you do as vice president of the Bucks, but is there a comparison you can make between the image makeover the Bucks relationship with the community has had over the past few years and the effect of hosting a large-scale world stage event like this, the effect it might have on how Milwaukee presents itself, both to itself and to the world?
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the reasons why we thought keeping the Bucks here was so important was not just because, you know, sports teams are important to a community and, you know, the inspiration, hope that they give. I mean, it's called fan because you're fanatical. It's an irrational relationship that you have, and why that was important. It's also important what it does nationally. I mean, having a international superstar on our team wearing Milwaukee across his chest. You know, I know that when I was in, you know, when I was in middle school and I watched, you know, Michael Jordan and Patrick Ewing, the colleges I wanted to go to were North Carolina and Georgetown. And, you know, I don't think my parents would have let me go to a Jesuit school, but I think those are the things that resonate with people because they see that. And then you grow up thinking, oh, I didn't want to be like that person. So now when you see people in Europe, in Greece, you know, my sister went to Greece on her honeymoon. She wore a Bucks shirt and Bucks bracelets. I mean, she had to take off the Bucks bracelets and give them to people because everyone was such big Bucks fans. And it's not Bucks fans, they're Milwaukee fans now. So that's now growing up in Europe, you're going to see Giannis wearing Milwaukee. So not only are you going to be like, oh, I want to go to New York, Chicago, San Francisco, but now Milwaukee is in that conversation just because Giannis wears it on his chest. And same thing with the Democratic National Convention. People see that Milwaukee has the ability to host a convention like this. It not only shows younger people like, hey, this might be a place for me. It also shows conventions, corporations that, oh, you know, I never thought of Milwaukee as a place that could host this. You know, we were always told Milwaukee doesn't have enough hotel rooms. You know, Milwaukee doesn't have enough entertainment. Oh, if they're choosing this and they're having a successful convention here, this is now a place for me. And I think that's what we're really trying to show is that, hey, corporations, hey, other conventions, you should be here. This is a place that you want to be. This is a place that's going to be exciting. And this is a place where you will be able to have a successful convention or corporate relocation.
You have one pretty politically active player on rehab right now. Is there a role for Malcolm Brogdon in a Democratic convention effort?
You know, I leave what the players want to do on their own time up to them. You know, we're always supportive of anything that any of our guys want to do, whether it's politically or in the community, or if there are any interest issues that they want to be a part of. We are very supportive of all their efforts. I am not going to ask any of them to be a part of this. Again, this is a separate thing that I'm doing, just trying to, you know, Milwaukee is my home. I've bought a place here. This is where I'm living, and I plan on living here for, you know, for the foreseeable future. I can't imagine now living anywhere else. And so, you know, I want to do this and be a part of this effort because I want the country to see what I see in Milwaukee. And that's a very special place that has, you know, great culture and entertainment and is a big city and is a major city in the region. And that's why I'm trying to be a part of this effort and trying to bring that kind of spotlight to a city that I think deserves it.
Well, Alex Lazary, thank you so much for your time and best of luck in this work.
Thank you.
Alex Lazary is Senior Vice President of the Milwaukee Bucks, and he's the leader of the effort to bring the 2020 Democratic National Convention to Milwaukee.
A short break now, then award-winning filmmaker and novelist John Ridley joins us to talk about the investment he's making in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Last week, Oscar-winning filmmaker and Milwaukee native John Ridley formally unveiled plans to bankroll a new for-profit creative hub in an old Pabst Brewery building on West McKinley Avenue.
It's a part of downtown that is seeing growth and redevelopment already, with new condos and other multi-use spaces going up. Ridley's space, which is called No Studios, is a business venture with Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley. The three-story, 40,000-square-foot facility will feature a 50-seat screening room, food and beverage services, galleries, and a rooftop event space.
The idea is to give artists of all sorts the chance to showcase their talents, no matter what that art background might be. Clients can sign long or short-term leases, and Milwaukee Film, 371 Productions, and the UWM School of Film are among those already on board.
I caught up with Ridley after the press conference to learn more. John Ridley, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
This is such an interesting project. What is it that made you say, I want to reinvest in Milwaukee?
I love Milwaukee. It's my birth city. It's where I'm from. It's one of those interesting, eclectic places. You know, you say Milwaukee to people and they go, I've never been to Milwaukee. I'm like, how have you even never been to Milwaukee? It's one of those places that I don't know, and I can only speak because this is the only birthplace I know. It just never really leaves you. And what it was about and the experiences I had here, wanting to make sure that every individual from Milwaukee who might dream about being a storyteller, an artist, or a filmmaker doesn't just have to dream about it and figure out what is that roadmap from here to there. That, to me, it became sort of a driver. I think the more I went out in the world and fewer people knew about Milwaukee, knew about the city, knew about the kinds of folks that were here, the only thing they really were aware of were Laverne and Shirley. It was like, you know, I want people to understand the values, the fact that just Wisconsin in general has always been a very progressive place. You know, there is a city, there are always problems and challenges, but this is a very progressive city, it's a very progressive state. And if I had the opportunity, you know, look, I've lived in New York and Los Angeles and London. I can't really make a huge difference in those places. I can be a good citizen and try to be a responsible person. I think that's very important for all of us to do. But to come back to Milwaukee and know that you can really make a difference here and you can partner with individuals who see the value in what you're trying to do, that was very important to me as well.
What is it about growing up here, do you think, that has informed your own art? Because you're both a writer and a filmmaker.
I am a writer first, and I think I've tripped into being a filmmaker and wanting to tell stories. I think it was being in a space where it was very open-minded, but at the same time, I did not have the opportunity to cross-pollinate with a lot of different demographics. I think I was always encouraged to have a worldview, but didn't always have to have that worldview tested. And I think that's one of the interesting things, is to be in a place where you're encouraged to think and you're encouraged to experience. And it is a city of festivals, but it is still a very tight demographic. And then to go out in the world and say there were a lot of really terrific values that were instilled in me that came from a lot of different places, but having those values instilled and having those values tested is a whole other thing. So to come back and try to encourage people and say, hey, the values that you're getting here are really terrific values, but are we putting them to work here in Milwaukee? Are we putting them into effect here? You know, there are a lot of things about Milwaukee that I wasn't aware of in terms of the city being segregated in many ways, having real socioeconomic divides. You know, my experience is not everyone's experience. And saying, hey, if I can make it, that's really a terrific thing, but am I doing everything to ensure that the things that I think that are wonderful about Milwaukee, they're not just my experience, they're experiences that can be shared by anyone and should be shared by everyone who wants to be a participant in their own better lives.
How do you see this space, once it opens, the No Studios, how do you see that space helping to do that? Are you reaching out to individuals? Are you looking at people who have already got small production companies? Who are you aiming this toward?
All of that. We are certainly, for our long-term tenants, we're aiming at individuals who have production companies, who are up and running, who want a space that is more dedicated to their profession and understands their needs and their desires. We are certainly moving towards the educational spaces. We're partnering with the local universities, and education really is a very important component, because it's one thing certainly to get that classroom education, very important to have those fundamentals, but are those students exposed to real-world education and individuals who are working outside of the Milwaukee area and can hopefully talk to them about what their expectations could be or should be as they move out into the larger entertainment or creative spaces. We certainly want to direct it towards individuals who've been traditionally disenfranchised and may think that the arts isn't something for them or something that they could obtain, to know that whether it's talkbacks or screenings or exhibitions or what have you, if you just have a general interest, you're invited. You may not know what you want to do yet in the arts, but you have an affinity towards it. Or as I said in the presentation, if you're a senior designer, if you like working with costumes or wardrobe or what have you, those are all parts of the artistic endeavor as well. It's not just the writers, it's not just the actors or the directors. Almost any job that's out there can be applied in some way to the artistic and creative spaces. And then, most importantly, the patrons. We want to make sure that people who patronize, if they want to be involved in some way, if they have an interest, if we have special screenings, if we have special events, throughout the history of arts, it's been those who have supporting those who want to achieve and want to express and need that support.
Oh, I think audience is that other piece that so often gets forgotten. Because if you don't have somebody watching it, listening to it, seeing
it's a tree falling in the woods.
Exactly.
And you look at things that are going on out there. People ask me, how do I feel about Black Panther or Wonder Woman, Lady Bird, or all of those films that have a cultural density? That's terrific. I love telling stories too, but if I'm telling these stories for myself, it's not really a mover. So in all of these spaces, in all of these ways, it really is about bringing together these disparate communities and saying, you all need to know each other, and you all can benefit from knowing each other. And there is an excitement and there's an enthusiasm. What we want to do is keep that going.
What was the thought behind making this a for-profit rather than nonprofit? Most of the people in the arts are used to the nonprofit model.
Yeah, and most of those people are also, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, they're used to people coming to them and asking for donations or writing grants. I think one of the issues has been over time that, particularly I think when you're talking about regional storytellers, how do you get money? How do you get funding? It's grants. It's going to people for funding. It's looking for donations. That's all terrific. I really don't want to disparage that model, but we don't want to come into a space and be disruptive for other individuals who are already looking for grants, who are looking for money, who are looking for people who are supporting through donations, particularly in the Milwaukee area where that space may be limited. And also not necessarily having a bulwark or a rainy day sense of how we're operating. If you're looking for grants and donations, if the economy hits tough times, everybody's looking for a smaller pool. In a for-profit space, like any other business, we certainly got to be responsible. But with a business, you're looking at the good days, you're looking at the bad days, you're looking at how are we over time sustaining ourselves. So we're not trying to reach into anybody else's pocket. We want to make sure that we're looking at what we're doing and making sure that every single day we have something that incentivizes everybody, no matter who you are or where you're from, to come and participate. But knowing that if we are generating a profit, part of that is going back into the good work that we want to be able to do. For me, as profitable as this may be, this is not going to be, it is not going to be the profit driver the way it is when I'm working at Disney or I'm working at Sky or Showtime or doing those other things.
This isn't your retirement.
This is not my retirement, but knowing that the other things that I'm doing in my life can sustain this and support this and provide an enthusiasm towards this, then I know that we're doing the right thing.
So when this gets going, in the perfect universe, what does it look like for you? What do you want to see happening in this space?
I would love to be able to walk into the space and, you know, from the beginning of the day, seeing people come in who are working with purpose. Later in the day, see people socializing with purpose. And as the day progresses, knowing that we have the potential to have screenings or exhibitions, to have a third space for people who are involved or interested in the arts in some fashion. It really is for us about socializing with purpose. And that's been a big part of my career. And I think one of the things when people think about writers, you know, they're off in a coffee shop or cafe, you know, drinking, smoking, angry individuals. But a lot of that is knowing that you're around people who are going to be supportive, that can look at your work and give you an honest assessment of what you're doing, that you're not alone, that you really, you know, you're not becoming a hermit with your work. You're out somewhere where you can see how people interact. You can listen to their dialogue, how they talk. You know, that's what we want to do with this space, is know that people are socializing with purpose. So we have long-term tenants. We have short-term tenants who are coming in and maybe working on a project. We have a screening room. So when people have a project, you know, where do I go? Where do I screen? You know, we're, it's not a big enough film, perhaps, for the Oriental Theater. But I want to get some feedback on it, or I want to have a special screening. We have that capacity. And then we have an event space up top where people can come and, you know, if they want to bring people in, or if they want to have a launch event, if they want to just bring folks in to talk about what they're doing, we have those spaces within the hub.
And are you going to be bringing any of your work here to show?
I certainly hope so. Last year when we had Let It Fall, we ended up doing several screenings here and we did not have a space, so I'd love to screen it here. I hope and believe that certainly, you know, you talked about the differences between my two careers. I hope that the work that I do out in Hollywood or wherever, we actually don't shoot that much in Hollywood, wherever we're shooting, that work can come and can be exhibited here, shown here, bring some of my famous friends here. It really is incumbent upon me in the next couple of years to do as much work as I possibly can to help support this business here. You know, at this point, the no space, I think it's terrific space, it's still a lost leader for me. So I got to go out and do as much as I can to try to support this space, because it's of emotional, educational, intellectual value to me to make this work. So yes, the short answer to your question is whatever I'm doing out there, I certainly will be trying to bring here.
John Ridley, thank you so much.
Absolutely, thank you.
Award-winning filmmaker and Milwaukee native John Ridley, his No Studios is scheduled to open this fall in the old Pabst Brewery.
We'll take one last break, and then Milwaukee poet Ed Block joins us to read from his new collection of poems, Seasons of Change. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We first met poet Ed Block last January when his first book of poems, Anno Domini, was published. That collection had a very clear religious emphasis. Each poem reflected on a point during the liturgical day.
Block, who taught English at Marquette University for 35 years, is back with a second collection. Seasons of Change is decidedly secular, although like its predecessor, it uses the passage of time as a way to explore the world.
Block takes part in a reading tonight at Woodland Pattern Book Center, but he joined us first. Here he is with a poem, Spring Migration, for Ted Kooser.
The snow around the tree recedes, their winter trails exposed. The voles make for the matted leaves, the cracks between the land and stone, the gaps beneath the bent and broken iris stems that mark the garden's edge. They curse the march of spring and vow to stay abed all day when once they find their summer home again.
Ed Block, welcome back to Lake Effect.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you back. And this is part of your new collection, Seasons of Change. And the last time we talked was about a collection that you wrote around the liturgical clock.
Yeah. Right.
And this is obviously not that, but it is also kind of a circuitous, you know, going from one season to the other and then back again. So you seem to find yourself doing these circles.
I think the seasons are a real orientation for me. And certainly as we look forward to the spring, I'll probably be getting new inspirations as things start popping out of the ground.
Nature plays such a crucial role in this collection.
Right. Nature people, circumstances, even, curiously enough, derelict homes can be moments of revelation with a small r, and just paying attention to them and trying to bring them into words is a way of trying to acknowledge that, to recognize their value. And it's also a way of revitalizing myself, and I hope sharing that with others.
Was there any difference in the way you approached writing these poems from the first collection that you did?
Well, because so many of the others in Anno Domini also had nature to it, there's that blend. But I would have to say that the secular element in these distinguishes them from the ones that have an obvious spiritual or, if you will, religious dimension to them.
No matter what the subject of the poem, are you approaching it in the same way, whether it's religious or secular?
I would say it's Denise Levertov's organic theory of poetry, a perception that generates a thought that may issue in a particular phrase, and that phrase then builds or calls forth another phrase. So yeah, the process is pretty much the same, but why one leads to a revelation with a small r and another poem goes in the direction of revelation with maybe a capital R, I'm not sure why.
That's part of the poetic process.
Yeah, right.
and the mystery of it,
that's
I
right.
think. Are you one of those poets that has a little notebook with you and you're constantly, oh, you're going to pull it out, there it is.
Yes.
So you're constantly, when you see things that pop into your head, you're constantly jotting things down.
Driving home from Florida just the last 3 or 4 days, I'll see something in southern Alabama, in northern Tennessee, the panhandle of Florida, and a phrase will come to mind. And I don't do it, jot it down right then, but stop at a rest stop and I'll jot the phrase down. And yeah.
Do you go back every so often and mine your own notebooks?
I have boxes of notebooks, but since the workshop I took with Carolyn Forché in 2015, where she recommended that you write every day and then after a couple of weeks go back and look back at it, I'm looking back much more regularly than I used to. And there's a lot of stuff that just doesn't tweak me in a way to call for more revision. But if there's something there, I'll tease it out and work on it, yes.
And so you find that you're not leaving things untouched, that this forces you to go back and see if there's anything there.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly how she put it. Go back and see if there's anything there.
Well, there's quite a lot there. we're going to hear another poem. This is, again, from Seasons of Change. The poet is Ed Block. This is one that I particularly asked for, and it's about a ladder. So tell me about this one before you read it for us.
Well, it's an actual ladder that sits in our garage. We got it 20-some years ago when we moved to Greendale. And this, too, I would say, is a Couser-inspired poem. My ladder. Against the wall, beside the door inside the dark garage, my ladder leans. At 24, the oldest tool in this our second house. The dabs of brown and cream that spatter steps and rails recall our coming here. The ladder knows more than its telling of lives, our climbs, descents, and shaky standing still. The ladder, upright in its proper place, is way too smart to judge.
I really love that. And yes, it just sits there and says, no, I'm not going to comment on this. That's just a lovely poem. Thank you so much. Before we talk more, I want to hear another one. And this is one that I think you particularly wanted to read, called Morning in the Country.
That's right. That's right.
And so if you would set this one up for us.
Well, again, Ted Couser looks at the days and changes in the day, sometimes from odd perspectives. If you set this next to the poem that it's adapted from, you probably wouldn't see the connection, but somehow something in Ted's approach to looking at a morning got me going. Morning in the Country. The sun's up. Clouds cling to his jeans. He dusts them off. Mist settles in the hollows. He plods across the field, boots leaving shadows in the glades. He heads uphill to farms where birds he'd freed the last night call out for breakfast, scatters corn like gold, then rubs his palms with light.
Yeah, I love that one too. One of the things I love about both of these is the imagery is so particular, and I feel like I'm there.
That's Denise Levertov. She wants you to experience what she's experiencing. And if I'm able to make my reader experience something of what I'm seeing, then I guess I've achieved what I've set out to do.
Is writing enjoyable for you? Do you find, I know you're doing it every day and you're mining your old notebooks and that sort of thing, but is the actual process of trying to put those words into some sort of form that makes sense a pleasurable one for you?
Yes, it is, Bonnie, and that may put me at odds with a lot of contemporary poets, even some of the best that I admire, who talk about struggling. Now, maybe it's that my poetry doesn't grab the way Christian Wiman or some of the other poets that I've read and admire at a distance, but no, it's very pleasurable. I think I far too iambic. It's far too regular than a lot of modern poets would countenance. But that's the way it comes, and on occasion I'll struggle to revise for a little more roughness, for something more like that'll catch your attention. At least one or two of the ones I'm going to read later on will be of that sort.
Right, where you maybe disturb the rhythm a little bit.
That's
so
right.
That it kind of catches you, which I think for me, some of the best poetry does, even when it is regular in an iambic form or something like that, there's usually something that kind of makes you say, wait a minute, what's that?
Another of my favorite mentors, Mary Oliver, in a book called A Poet's Notebook, she takes Robert Frost's Standing Winter, you know, snowy winter, whatever it is, she takes that poem and looks at how the strict iambic rhythm is nuanced in ways that you wouldn't have believed is there, and you don't notice it. You don't notice how the rhymes work. I'd like to say that's what I'm trying to do with my iambic lines, but there's not that much deftness to them yet. I'm still working.
You're still working on it. Well, let's hear another one. This is another one that you wanted to read, which was In the Keys with Maggie.
Ah, yes. Inspired by a couple we met on the bus coming back from Key West. They'd spent the day drinking and celebrating their anniversary. He'd been a cook, but was now making a living as a part-time fisherman. In the Keys with Maggie, homage to Elizabeth Bishop. My lame place on Summerland, my prince's palace, cozy as a clam. It's vinyl and aluminum, a double wide, with AC on the roof, a picture window on the sea. This dump, my love nest, sports bleached oak for cabinets, a cast iron fry pan in a stainless tub. The laundry hangs outside, my girlfriend Maggie's bra and panties next to oilskins that I wear when I go fishing in the Gulf for tarpon, oysters, razorbacks, which seldom bite. When I come home, we drink tequila, jump in bed, and don't wake up until the morning light when we hear roosters crow or tourists on the causeway. And better than the fish, my Maggie bites.
That's wonderful.
And our hearers won't see the line endings, but the line breaks are also meant to disturb the regularity that the iambic rhythm may enforce on you. So when you look at it, you got to be careful about the line endings.
Right. You have to actually pay attention.
That's it.
To what it is. You know, and it's so funny, of course, I always think of Hemingway when I think of the Keys. And there's a little touch of that in there, too, I think.
Oh, do we have enough time to do Duval Street?
Sure.
All right. This one tries to catch the bustle and the unique flavor of Key West. Duval Street's the main thoroughfare. The Commodore is a famous restaurant. Henry Flagler was a 19th century tycoon who developed much of southern Florida, even built a railroad that went to Key West. And the Dry Tortugas is a group of islands west of the Key West. And one of the characters is also from the previous poem. Duval Street. Down Duval, swept with the crowd of visitors to the shore. The cruise ships tower over everything. The tourist trains, the pirates, and the pretty maids with tattooed legs and arms who walk along, tall drinks above their heads. The pedicabs joust with the motorbikes. Street artists swim against the waves of men in shorts and women in straw hats and sandals, swirling skirts. Expensive cars display their chrome and tinted glass and push through crowded streets. But in the byways beneath live oaks and bougainvillea, the shadows gather. Roosters scratch and root beneath the duff, under the slashed pines and the cypresses, as if in search of keys to mysteries. A breeze from off the gulf portends a storm before nightfall. The drunken chef shouts from the back door of the Commodore, wishing himself back in the days of Henry Flagler or Ernest Hemingway. Dark ghosts who gather over the dry Tortugas. Red sundown, a heartbeat's length away.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I'm having you read these poems as we're talking, what does reading them do for you as a poet?
Makes me realize how much more I have to learn. I notice places where they could be better according to my standards, and it's humbling. Some of them, like Maggie, that one I'll read over and over again. But there are places that could I make it better? People like W.H. Auden revised his collected works right up to the end of his life, and the editors and the scholars say, at that. But reading aloud is the way poetry should be experienced. But as the reader, and if you're the writer of the poem, it can be humbling.
When you read them for people, does the audience reaction to them make you want to go back and revise?
I don't think so. The reaction helps. It makes me go back and want to write some more and do it better. But the reaction to things like the Maggie poem has stimulated more of the Florida poems. I think when we were in Florida this year, I was thinking about the sorts of things that made Maggie work. And I hope they get into the poems that I'm writing about this year's Florida trip.
Well, we have time for a couple more poems, and I know you wanted to read Cinzano, White, and Red.
Yes.
And then let's do that one first. And why is this one that you want to share with us?
Well, as I was going to say, Seasons of Change is also about memory, and the memory of having been in the Peace Corps years ago and suddenly having these memories come back. Many of the memory poems, the Africa poems, are obviously memory poems. And so that's why they got in here. Memory is an important part of my process, too. This was inspired by a poster in a local restaurant where my wife and I have breakfast every other Friday. One Friday a couple Decembers ago, I saw a poster I hadn't seen before or hadn't noticed for an aperitif that we used to drink in Malawi. And it was just that fast. I was back into Malawi, and this poem came out over a number of weeks. But it was like going back to my time in Malawi. Cinzano, White, and Red. A gaudy restaurant poster for vermouth. The grapes, the swirls of color edged in black, around a supine model whose flying hair obscures her face. The flavor of the sight is sweet, astringent, with just a hint of wormwood. Passion over ice, enjoyed before and after meals, or sex. Years ago, it was a favorite drink in Central Africa. Pungent midnight, the southern stars so near. Expat passengers, female and male, lovers and friends on the open upper deck. A packet anchored in the bay. Faint lights from the shore reflected on the water mix with the stars. Below, the sounds of Bantu passengers embarking noisily, the thrumming of the diesel, surging, surging to push off. Now the present takes possession of the past again, but the past refuses to dissolve. A ship sets out for Mozambique, the north, a steamy green adventure freighted with passion and regrets. So now, a farewell sip, a final toast. You ghosts of yesteryear, adieu. Return, remain, so far away, so near, so dear.
You know, it's amazing how, like you say, a fragment of something can bring back that an entire experience. And we've all had that experience, just most of us don't write poetry about it. But, you know, where you think it's so real, you could reach out and touch it.
That's right.
And that's what this feels like.
It is.
Yeah. You know, and you can almost, you can smell the diesel and you can and feel the heat and taste the vermouth.
And I think the revelation, paying attention to those sights, those sounds, as you say, smell is a very key awakener of memories. And it puts you and who you are in a different place. And to bring back Malawi is important for me because it was a formative experience in both my and my wife's experience. So,
well, Ed Block, it is such a pleasure having you in the studio to hear about this second collection. I'm hoping you will leave us with the poem that I didn't even realize when I asked you to do it, that, of course, it's about the butterfly that's on the cover.
And it's a photo that I took in our yard a couple few years ago. And as I was looking through possibilities for the cover, I came upon the picture, and then the poem came. Red Spotted Purple. Uncommon name, a common Midwest butterfly. Find it on the roadsides, in the road. It poises lightly on the muddy ground. It also lands on dung. May to October, one can come as a surprise, a spot of blue that interrupts a walk. Cold-blooded like a snake, it basks in the sun, wings open, veins conveying heat along the filmy membranes. Brush-footed, tarsy-tasting flowers, its dark wings, covered with fine, dusty scales, have an iridescent hue. The feet, with little claws, help grip the leaves. A look-alike for its toxic cousin, the red-orange spots can be most stunning. With opening and closing of its wings, it gives a sense of peace and new beginnings.
Again, Ed Block, thank you so much.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Bonnie.
Milwaukee poet Ed Block's new collection is called Seasons of Change. He'll read from it tonight at Woodland Pattern Book Center, along with Bayview poet Jenny Benjamin. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com. And that is Thursday's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for listening today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning and night at 10 o'clock for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.